Yesterday morning at 2:41 a.m. at General Eisenhower's headquarters, General Jodl, the representative of the German High Command, and of Grand Admiral Dönitz, the designated head of the German state, signed the act of unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe to the Allied Expeditionary Forces and simultaneously to the Soviet High Command. Today is Victory in Europe Day. Tomorrow will also be Victory in Europe Day. Long live the cause of freedom.
This is a solemn but glorious hour. I wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to see this day. General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe. For this victory, we join in offering our thanks to the Providence which has guided and sustained us through the dark days of adversity and into light. Much remains to be done. The victory won in the West must now be won in the East. The whole world must be cleansed of the evil from which half the world has been freed. United, the peace-loving nations have demonstrated in the West that their arms are stronger by far than the might of dictators or the tyranny of military cliques that once called us soft and weak. The power of our peoples to defend themselves against all enemies will be proved in the Pacific War as it was proved in Europe.
You're listening to a special live broadcast from the beach at Normandy on the 70th anniversary of D-Day, June 6th, 1944. Here is Jerry Evans on 99.1 FM Talk.
And a good morning to you live from Normandy, France, here on the beach at the historic town of Olgut here in France. I want to go back to the message from Gene Herman to remind you to get out and vote and don't take your freedom for granted. And again, the thing I just want to go back and continue to mention is what we saw yesterday, which was the French, and what we see today, the French celebrating liberty today and not taking their freedom for granted. And you heard the British Normandy Veterans Association member who, that was Douglas, who thanked America for helping them out. As they said, we couldn't have done it without you. Also want to mention the Facebook, the photo of Cosmo Utero, who you heard a couple of moments ago. It's on our Facebook page. Clinton Riddle there, as well as some of the Normandy Veterans Association members. Wanted to mention, too, yesterday we visited the German bunkers above the beach. And as much as I hate to refer back to, but I will, Hollywood and the movies, and Saving Private Ryan is a good example of what that was like, because it's 1,000 yards of nothing but open beach and sand. The tide is in a little bit right now, but that's what I was looking at this morning, is just completely open country. The German guns up on the hillside with absolutely nothing really to protect the soldiers from running onto the beach, the hedgehogs and all the other obstacles. A lot of those had mines on them, which the soldiers, if a American soldier was taking refuge behind one of those hedgehogs, a lot of times they would shoot those and continue to just slaughter American troops for a good 3 to 4 hours before they made any headway. As we get into the 8 o'clock here back at home, they were 2 hours into this slog to get up to the beach and to try to make headway inland. Don't forget again what they sacrificed. And although walking around the cemetery and everything, very somber mood there, the Normandy Veterans Association, the British guys, were having a party. They did a march through the town of Colville, Montgomery. General Montgomery was the British commander, and they've got a big statue of him, and they did a ceremony there. And you heard us talk to the Normandy Veterans Association members, who are just having a fantastic time and happy to be alive. A little more appropriate somber mood at the cemetery there at Omaha Beach. But again, I want to point out that the D-Day vets that were either in wheelchairs or walking around were treated like rock stars. We'd start to talk to one of them to interview them, and 20, 30 people would gather around just to hear their stories as we asked them questions. I think maybe some people were a little intimidated or a little embarrassed, a little shy to go up and start talking to them. And I remember in particular one of the veterans on the walkway there next to the cemetery who was in a wheelchair, and there were 20 or 30 people gathered around him, and a beautiful blonde woman, looked like she was Swedish and had on military uniform, wanted her picture, and all the women were getting their pictures with that veteran. So it was very, very good to see. When the Germans invaded France in 1940, they took 1.4 million prisoners of war, French prisoners of war, sent them to concentration camps or to work in Germany. We're visiting with some other people from Nevada, from the Carson Valley right here. One of the other interesting stories that J. Carter Witt was telling me was the Nazi cemetery. And as he said, you go to the Nazi cemetery and all the headstones are black. Approximately 20 soldiers buried to the grave, and a completely different feeling than being at the American cemetery there where over 9,000 soldiers are buried. I want to get back and make sure that we don't run out of time. We've got a very special interview coming up with a woman named Pauline, and then also another D-Day vet that you heard on Fox News earlier, Clinton Riddle. And we talked about the somber mood and everything, and the British veterans. Clinton, very much like the British veterans, he was just happy. He's a character. We asked him if he got drafted or if he joined, and you'll love his answer. And Craig, if you've got Clinton all queued up, this is Clinton of the 325th Glider Infantry, and Clinton's from Tennessee.
I'm Clinton Riddle, R-I-D-D-L-E.
Where are you from, Clinton?
Sweetwater, Tennessee.
82nd or 101st?
82nd.
82nd?
325th Glider Infantry.
So did you come or drop in on a glider? Did you come in on a glider on D-Day?
Yes. Crash land St. Mary Glees. We fought for 33 days and nights without relief before we went back to England. On the 38th, we were able to go back to England out of the 155 that made the invasion. And I got word about 2 months ago, I'm the only known living survivor of the 155 that initially went in on D-Day.
You're the last one left, huh?
Yes, and only 10 out of it into our regiment.
Wow.
Composed of four companies.
Okay. Now, most people know about the story of the paratrooper that got his parachute caught on the steeple.
John Steele, yeah.
Did you know him?
I knew of him.
Okay.
He's from Steam, Erie. Mm-hmm.
And he died about 6 years ago, I understand.
I don't know just when.
Yeah.
I was here in 94, and they had a dummy hanging up there.
And obviously you made it through, and we're glad to see you. How old are you?
Just 93.
You'll be back for the 75th, I'm sure.
Well, I'm going to come for the 70th. I didn't think I could make 100.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
not only here, but I was in 6 battle zones, 4 of them invasion. I served in North Africa, French Morocco, Algiers, and Tunisia, made the invasion of Sicily, the invasion of Italy, and served in Ireland and England. And I was acting co-pilot going into Holland. We used the American CG-4A Walco glider for that. And then the Battle of the Bulge, I fought from the 18th of December, 44, to the 17th of February, 45.
I bet you don't miss that weather.
Well, I went from 130 degrees in Africa to zero in the Battle of the Bulge. Mm-hmm. My feet was frozen. I don't have any feeling about my feet now. Ready for 422 days under enemy fire. The first ones at Bastogne, and the 101st is after us. And when we got to Bastogne, they sent us on to Wibremont to set up a northern defense. And that's how come the 101st get trapped at Bastogne.
Mm-hmm. And you're the last surviving member of...
That's what they told me.
Okay.
The only known one. They could be somebody else, but anyway, that's the information they gave me.
Okay. And where were you on VE Day when you found out the war was over?
I was in Germany.
Do you remember that day well?
Oh, very well.
I talked to some Normandy veterans, some English guys, and they don't remember too much because they started drinking right away. Yeah. I don't know if you had that opportunity.
Yeah, we had a general that was going to show the Russians how to jump out of an airplane, and they got up there and got drinking the vodka, and he jumped out the window to demonstrate and broke his leg.
Crazy Ruskies. What award did you win today?
Today?
You were given an award?
I was made honorary member. Yeah,
member of the...
Normandy 82nd.
Yeah.
Normandy 82nd.
Yeah.
Do you remember, did you volunteer back then?
No, no.
You got drafted.
They chased me down. I was drafted.
Thank you very much, Rennell. God bless you. Thanks for your service.
Thank you.
We're broadcasting live to you from the historic village of Olgut, France, here on the coast. And I had invited Rob Archie to tell me a story that I thought was worth sharing. And Rob, I'll just forewarn you, there's about a 2-second delay. So I'm going to hand this off to you. If you can repeat the story that you told me that just happened in the last couple of years or so about a member of your family.
How you doing, Jerry? I'm proud to be on this show, especially on this particular occasion, D-Day. So thanks for having me on. Well, I mean, I've lived in Reno for 34 years, but I came from the Buffalo Niagara Falls area, and I have a very large family. On my dad's side, there were 13 brothers and sisters, and one of them, my Aunt Rosie, had a boyfriend who was in D-Day, and eventually when he came home, they were married. And he was in the 82nd Airborne, and so he was in D-Day, also was in... He was also in the Battle of the Bulge and a few other things. But during the time that he was there, one of the things that he always said that kept him going was the love letters he would get from my Aunt Rosie. Just to give you an idea of some of the things she would say to him, one of the letters, it was, "Darling, I hope this letter helps you understand some of the feelings I have being away from you on this special day," which, by the way, D-Day was my Uncle John's birthday. It says, "My prayer tonight is that God will watch over you and keep you safe, and that next year you will be home." From Rose to John D'Amore on his birthday in 1944. And by the way, I'm Irish-Italian, and D'Amore stands, believe it or not, for love. So it's a very interesting story. And he was in Belgium at a point during the war in 1945, and he had a box. It looks like an ammunition box from the paper clipping that I can see from when they printed this story a year and a half ago. And in that box, he kept the love letters that my Aunt Rosie would send him. And he said that he kept many of them there, and photos of all the guys that were in the 82nd with him that, you know, fought in the battles and so on. And then he was wounded. He broke his ankle and then was wounded, and so he was shipped off to some place in the rear, and then wound up back home, and then lost this box of love letters. So never knew where they went, never knew what happened to them, and all of a sudden, a year and a half ago, a lady in Belgium was cleaning out her father-in-law's attic and found this box with my uncle and my aunt's letters in it. And it's a great story, because the heading on the paper, on the newspaper, says "Love Remains, World War II era love letters returned to native and 82nd Airborne soldier."
Sounds like a movie.
That's a great story, Robin. I appreciate you calling in and sharing that.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's been great. It's been a great thing. And the best part about this, if I may, is the fact that my uncle was 91 when he died last year, but my aunt is still alive. But he got those letters from her at a time when she was suffering from dementia, so she, you know, she was kind of lost to him in that respect. So to hear her voice again after all those years when he couldn't talk to her at that point, I think was a gift from God. At least that's the way I see it.
Absolutely. Great story. Thank you, Rob. I appreciate that very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to 99.1 FM Talk, KKFT. Now, Craig, just to give you kind of a timeline of history here, as Nevada being a state that's, isn't it, right at 150 years here this October, I'm actually about a 5-minute walk from the port where William the Conqueror, also called William the Bastard, apparently he was one, left the port about, like I said, it's maybe about 2,000 yards down the beach for me. He left that port in the year 1066 to conquer England, and did. So just to give you a bit of a history of where we're standing on the French coast here on the English Channel. Pauline is a very interesting woman who lived in a very historic home here in France called Val Roucher. It's approximately 10 miles from where I'm standing right now. And we had a great conversation in this historic home. It was built as an abbey in 1150. It's a, what does that make it, about an 850-year-old home. And we were there with her for a good long visit, and we've condensed that to a couple of segments that we're going to get to here in just a couple of moments here on KKFT, live from Normandy, France. I'm Jerry Evans for 99.1 FM Talk, KKFT.
These guns were pointed and firing right down on the beach, and the people out of the landing craft were trying to come onto the beach, and they were firing right down on them.
Live from Normandy on the 70th anniversary of D-Day, honoring those who served. This is KKFT 99.1 and AM 1300. And 102.5 KCMY.
This battery of 105s was placed precisely where it should be to protect that causeway, any troops coming up the causeway. As you sit back years later on and look at it, you think, oh, this was laid out exactly right, tactically.
My Uncle RJ, a great uncle, fought in this war very close to Normandy. And he always held a horror box that he would never show me. And I always wanted to see it, and he told me that is something no woman should ever see. And when he passed away, we had a family reunion, and his son and I went and looked in the box. And it was pictures, and it was maps, and it was drawings, and it was, I guess you would call it logistics reports of what he did during the war. And it was truly horror. There were pictures of bodies piled up and battles that they had fought and friends that he had lost that were bloody and wounded. And this is the greatest generation. And I just want every young American, and I'm 51 years old and still think I'm a young American, that we need to respect these troops. We need to understand the sacrifices and what people saw and what they went through that they wouldn't share for a whole generation just so that we could be free. Let's give them respect and give them everything they're due. And to the troops, thank you for your service, and we appreciate you and we love you.
Melinda from Dynamic Diesel, one of our sponsors on this historic day in France and for the United States of America. Live from Normandy, France, on the beach, on the English Channel, Jerry Evans for KKFT. C. Carter Witt told me a great story about a Frenchman who refused to allow Nazis and the German soldiers to be buried on his property. The French government was going to take the property for a German cemetery. He refused. He stood in front of his property and said, there will not be a Nazi buried on my property. And he was shot by the French government. Dynamic Diesel, Northern Nevada Coin, and thank you very much for your sponsorship of our broadcast this morning. We did an interview with a woman named Pauline, a historic chateau called Val Roucher. And if you want to Google Earth it, it's Val, spelled like Val Richer, Val Roucher. And we're running out of time, so I want to get to Pauline. And she refers to something called pom-poms, like the girls with pom-poms, what those were, which were dropped around her property from the air that night when D-Day started just after midnight, were like gold foil, and that was to confuse the radar so that the planes would not be picked up. So without any further ado, that's French, by the way, Craig. I picked that up while I was here. Let's go to Pauline at the historic Val Roucher in France.
We took a train by night. For us children, it was very special, you know. Mm-hmm. And we came here. And when the war was declared, all the family went here.
They met here at this location.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody was here. And asking, what are we going to do? Where are we going to go? What's going to happen? Asking questions to each other. And one of my cousins was born in Deauville during that time. And then when we knew the Germans were going in France as in butter, we went away. With my mother, we went in Brittany. Some went in the south. And was left here only my grandparents.
They stayed here in this home?
They stayed here. And the Germans arrived. And they went immediately to La Commandanture, to the Germans' place in Lisieux. And they told them, it's an old house. It's a museum. Don't touch it. So they gave a paper to my grandparents saying, don't touch Le Val Richer.
Officers, German officers said, do not destroy or do not damage.
Take care of this house, this part of the house. So we had the paper on the door inside, and they could read it. And so they lived in the house, but dans l'aile, what we call l'aile, the other part, in the farm, au bâtiment normand. And so we went from a place to another as they changed places.
So you didn't feel frightened or anything, or just...
No. They were not, you know, SS or things like that. Mm-hmm. They were the regular army. They were nice, in fact.
So they respected the wishes to protect the home and what was in it.
Yes, they never came in this one.
And did you house German soldiers here in this property? Did some stay here and live here?
Yes, of course. But in other parts of the house, not in the main part, never.
And your grandparents were never harmed or anything? They stayed the entire time?
And we too, the children. Yeah. We were 8 or 9 or something like that.
So you were inconvenienced, but it wasn't like you were frightened all the time or felt threatened at all?
No, never.
D-Day, do you remember D-Day when the invasion took place? Yeah. Where were you then?
Here.
You were here in this home?
Yeah.
And the bombing that started in the middle of the night, did you hear that?
No, I remember in the morning, you know, it was very windy. It was very bad weather. And we've seen a lot of planes, you know,
flying
bombing and everywhere. Mm-hmm. And they let fall some pom-pom. You see what the pom-pom girls have in their hand? The same thing, but en papier d'argent. Gold, Colville, naturellement, of course. Yeah. And Omaha Beach and all that kind of places. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't go on the beach. We have a small house. Mm-hmm. On the beach, not far from here, and that we loved, but we couldn't go during the war because there were Germans all along the beach, and so all along the beach.
When D-Day started happening, could you hear gunfire or the bombs in the distance or anything, or did it wake you up?
No, we didn't hear.
No.
We were very surprised by all the planes. I had a stepfather who was living in Paris, and he didn't knew. He was, you know, doing some resistance. How would you say resistance?
The French resistance, yes. He was a part of that.
Voilà. Not deeply, but he knew things. And he came here to bring my mother back, because she was in Paris, and to put her in calm place, and he went away. He was on a motorbike, and he stopped in a cafe to drink a coffee. Mm-hmm. And the man said, you know, it's le débarquement in Caen and all that. And he didn't knew. So he came back 2 days after, and he took us to Paris.
Because by then, everybody was aware that the invasion was going on,
they were afraid we could be killed, or so everybody went away except my grandfather and my grandmother.
They stayed here.
Stayed always.
Do you remember what the German soldiers that were here did on D-Day? Do you know where they called to?
I know they disappeared all of a sudden.
They were just gone, huh?
They were gone, and nobody was coming. The family, my grandfather and my grandmother were alone. And suddenly, a Canadian tank, passed over there. And so they said, it's finished.
And that was it, huh?
And it was, wait. But we had the bombing of Lisieux.
Which is, in Lisieux, is approximately, yeah, how many miles from where we are right here?
Five.
About 5 miles.
But you went and you stopped in Lisieux,
mm-hmm,
to the railway with their train.
Mm-hmm. What was the feeling around here once the Germans were being pushed back toward Germany? Mm-hmm. Was it a feeling of jubilation or relief? Or what was the general feeling, do you remember, from then?
Very happy.
That the occupation was over.
Oh, yes, was over. And people were afraid, you know, by the Germans anyway. Not here, because we had, it's bad to say, nice ones. They never have been brute or bad or... But we prefer not to have them. And we had very young soldiers, 18 and even younger, and they were crying in the kitchen, saying, I would like to go back home. I would like to see my mother, and all that. Sad.
Part of the Hitler Youth was to have a lot of those troops here that had to be sad for them as it would be for Americans, too.
Exactly the same, the same. But they were with us, with the kids. They were nice.
And how long did they live here?
During the whole war.
For five years.
Audacier. We knew one because our parents called them Audacier. Steel eyes.
Mm.
Because he had, I suppose, blue eyes or gray, pale eyes, or I don't know. But we didn't know them more than that.
And your brothers, do you have brothers and sisters that were here at that time as well?
Yeah. We were 8 or 9 children, having great fun. And we did some resistance, you know. They had their guns and all that in the garage. They were living in the garage mostly, having their lunch and all that in the garage. And sometimes we, when there was nobody, we went in the garage and we took des balles.
Balls.
And,
bullets. The rounds.
And we put it in the, dans les tendrons.
You took their bullets and threw them in the lake.
Yeah.
So you were part of the French resistance.
Exactly.
Did they ever find out about any of that, or did they ever confront you?
Once. They did a huge feast in front of the house, because it was Hitler's birthday. So on the, from the top of the house until down, they had put flags, you know, the grand drapeau.
Nazi flag?
Yeah, with la croix gammée and everything. And it was beginning, they were talking, and, you know, you had all the soldiers and all that, and you had an orchestra, you know, the cuivre, splendid.
So they had a big event here, a big party, a big event.
And we were in the closet, you know, behind the volets qui étaient fermés, but we could see what was happening. And all of a sudden, a plane.
The sky was pretty clear coming across the channel. So since I was jump master, I could lie in the door, at the door of the plane with my head out in the slipstream looking down. And I saw the thousands of craft, ships, everything from LCIs to battleships down there in the channel. And I think that's when I first realized how large the invasion was, how tremendously large the invasion was.
You're listening to a special live broadcast from the beach at Normandy on the 70th anniversary of D-Day, June 6th, 1944, on 99.1 FM Talk.
And a good morning to you. Running very late, Jerry Evans for 99.1 FM Talk from Normandy, France, this morning. Jerry Evans for KKFT. And just a quick couple of mentions of email from Carol down in the Carson Valley, who appreciates the fact that I took a picture of her uncle's cross, put a flower in front of it. I'll bring that home with me or email it before I get home. And a brother-in-law in Canada listening to the show online as well. Appreciate that. Jay Carter, Witt of the Bungalow, sent me a couple of pictures. And Jay, I'm going to post that child praying in front of the cross. Your wife took the picture a week or so ago at the cemetery. I'm going to post that on Facebook, and I hope you don't mind. And again, the photos of the D-Day vets, the Normandy vets, they're all posted on our Facebook page. And also Art, thanks for your service, Art. Didn't realize it. Retired Navy from Sun Valley. Jack Lucas was a young man who joined the Marines when he was 14. He could have been the one that was killed on the beach when he was 15. I'm not sure. Okay, I'm going to go to the governor, and then we'll get back to the part two of the interview with Pauline from Val Rouchet in France. Governor, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I wanted to invite you on and just see if I can maybe just get some thoughts from you on what D-Day means to you, to Nevada. Thank you for joining us this morning.
No, it's a true honor to be included today, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thoughts, family members, or just the historic significance of this day in American history?
It brings many thoughts. First and foremost, my grandfather fought in the Pacific Theater during World War II and was a decorated veteran, and so it really brings back fond memories for me of him. Obviously, this is a huge day in American history. It was the largest seaborne invasion in the history of mankind, and 160,000 soldiers who marched onto the beach and gave their lives for us and for freedom throughout the world. And then finally, you know, one of the big Nevada connections is the USS Nevada was one of the battleships that was out there and participated in the invasion as well.
Governor, I wanted to share this with you. I mentioned it several times this morning in visiting the cemetery in Omaha Beach yesterday. And today in France, it is a somewhat of a holiday, and that I was so heartened to see all of the kids that were bussed in from schools, French kids, and all of the people, all of the English people that were at the American cemetery yesterday and participating in the events and honoring and thanking Americans for their sacrifice on that day. I thought you'd be happy to hear that as well.
No, I truly am. And after 70 years, I think still people throughout the world know, understand, and appreciate the sacrifice that was made by the United States and our soldiers in terms of liberating France and Europe during World War II. And, you know, I've just taken time and ask all Nevadans and all Americans to take the time to pause and stop and pray and give thanks for what they did for us.
I agree. And Governor, from what little research I could find on Nevadans, D-Day veterans that are still alive in Nevada, was a number of 17. Originally it was 18, and the further I read, I found that one had died in January. And we're losing so many every single day. 750 to 1,000 die every day, and within 10 years, possibly less, they will all be gone. So I just wanted to thank you again for joining the show, sharing your thoughts, and appreciate if you can listen. I'm visiting with a woman at a historic chateau here in France, about 5 miles from where I am, who had German soldiers living in her family's home during the entire course of the year. So I hope you can stay and listen. And again, I thank you for your participation.
And again, thank you. It's an honor for me. You know, God bless the United States of America, the greatest nation on earth.
Thanks to our veterans. Thank you, Governor. And I'm going to have you give Rick a kind of a heads up. We're going to run into his show for just a few minutes, but I want to make sure that we get the rest of the conversation we recorded with Pauline, a significant French family in the history of France. I'll tell you a little bit about her great-great-great-grandfather, who is considered the Thomas Jefferson of France, who introduced education to all of the rural areas like Normandy in France, if we have a chance. So, Craig, without, again, let me fall on that French word that I learned while I was here. Without further ado, Pauline from Val Rocher in France.
So you said that the German soldiers, they would mostly live in the garage. They would eat their lunch out there. When they left, did they leave anything behind that you...
No.
They took their weapons, their firearms?
No. They disappeared.
They just disappeared? Now, I understand they left some drawings on the walls.
Yeah.
What were the drawings
of? It was the place they were living in the garage. They had their... what they ate... I don't know where they were cooking. I've never seen them cook something.
They didn't require your staff or the people here on the...
No.
They took completely by themselves.
By themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So they had their nourriture and their weapons at the other side of the garage.
Yeah.
And... they were living there, and I suppose they were going to the kitchen sometimes,
mm-hmm.
but not to cook. I don't think mm-hmm. so.
Because they're youth, and because they were probably bored and homesick, they did some drawings on the walls?
Yes.
What were the drawings of?
You have women. You had women in a swimming pool. You had just the women, a woman's head, and you had, you know, there's a story with the monkeys. One doesn't hear, the other one doesn't see, and the third one, what's happening to him?
Doesn't speak.
Can't speak, and it's a very well known story, you know. And so there were, they had drawn it on the wall also. Mm. And they had horses. But they were changing very often.
Probably all the things they missed from home.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot. Mm-hmm. A lot.
So after D-Day and after the battles that took place near here, and when the Germans finally left, life kind of returned back to normal. By then you were 12, 10 or 11 or...
Well, before the D-Day, we must have been 15 or something like that. The people working in the house. But we, my mother, my stepfather, my brother and I, we left the Val Rocher a few days after the D-Day. Because my stepfather came back to pick us up and take us back to Paris. He was afraid we could have something here. It was dangerous in a way.
And were you transported? Did you take trains then or vehicles?
No.
Automobiles?
In the dining room, you're going to have tea in a minute. You will see a big, big dining room. And at the end of the dining room, we had... My mother had a very, very small car. I think it was a Simca. And it was in the dining room because we had no essence, no gasoil, no nothing to put in it. And it was waiting for better days over there. And we took this car and we went four inside, very tight like that, and we went to Paris.
When you were a little girl seeing this, did you go through any of these villages that had been bombed? Did you notice any of the destruction from the bombing? Anything like that?
No, we didn't move. We not even went to Lisieux when we were during the war here.
Mm-hmm.
once, perhaps. My brother was going to school in Lisieux. But we didn't move. We were here.
Was anyone in your family a casualty of the war, or?
No, well, we had, in the family, we had two cousins who decided to go to London. So they took what we called a kayak.
A kayak across the channel.
Voilà. And so they did the war, and one was killed in Alsace, and the other one was just hurted. And another cousin, the same family, was doing some resistance in Paris. You know, he was very young, he was 17, and he went in a camp in Germany.
They sent him to a concentration camp.
Yeah, and he died over there. So it's a lot for the same family. And you know, sometimes we were landing on the les pelouses, on the grass, and looking the planes going to Germany, you know, les soucoupes volantes, we call this.
Flying saucers.
And we counted them. And there were a lot and a lot of them.
Do you remember how many you counted in one day?
No, but you had 60 or something like that, or 50. And we counted them when they came back from Germany. And some were missing.
Fewer planes came back than went over.
Yeah.
You started to tell me a story earlier where one day the Germans were outside, a plane came over. Do you remember what you were saying?
It was Hitler's birthday, and they were all on the pelouse, on the grass, and with music and all that. And a plane came very high. In a minute, you had nothing left.
They all scattered?
In the bushes, the flags down. In a minute, there was nothing left.
Probably part of Allied spy planes or something.
Yeah, they were afraid. They were afraid.
Yeah, yeah. Well, again, I just really want to thank you for having us here in your home.
I'm happy to have you.
Interesting life, no doubt.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I loved it, I must say.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sauvage. How do you say sauvage?
Wild.
You're a wild girl.
I'm wild.
A wild country girl.
Yeah, exactly. So
I'm sure the veterans listening to this radio show back in Nevada appreciate your taking the bullets and throwing them in the lake. Thank you, Pauline.
You're welcome.
And there you go. I don't know if you picked up on that, but the fact that there was no fuel, but they did have a small vehicle called a Sinca, and they kept it in the dining room. Yep, that's how big the dining room was in the house. Thanks to my host here in Ogot, and thanks to Pauline at Val Rocher. And thanks for the resistance, by the way, Pauline. Throwing those German bullets, it was a game for you a little bit as a girl. Throwing those German bullets into the lake on your property, you may have actually saved some Allied troops' lives. I hope you take the advantage to use your freedom today and vote. Today's the last day of early voting in Nevada. That right may not exist today if it weren't for our military. Thanks to Governor Brian Sandoval for joining the show today. And especially thanks to our sponsors, the Bungalows, J. Carter Witt. I got an email from him. That photo of the young child praying in front of the cross at the American Cemetery up from Omaha Beach will be posted on our Facebook page just a little bit from now. Brad Anderson, Anderson, Dorn, and Rader, appreciated the story very much about your two veteran parents, as well as putting me in touch with a D-Day vet living in Pocatello, Clarence of Vickery, Dynamic Diesel, and Melinda, that box of horrors story that she told, and her uncle with a map with lines drawn where he visited, the box of horrors. And Northern Nevada Coin, Alan, thank you very much for your sponsorship of the show. Thank you very much for listening. Rob, thanks for sharing that story about your uncle as well. Live from Normandy, France, I'm Jerry Evans for 99.1 KKFT.
These weren't just anonymous statistics. These were people that I knew. And these were, and I told my daughter, I said, this guy here died at age 19 or 20. A whole life, never lived. No family. Nothing. No children. No opportunity to have some satisfaction of building a life, nothing.
When I went there, I said, Dad, my gosh, Dad, you were so lucky. And he looked at me and he said, yeah, I'm very lucky, and he started crying.
These guys have been with each other in the absolute base experiences of human existence. They were there with each other, knowing you're going to die, or thinking you're going to die, or seeing people dying all around you. And there they went, day after day, and I admire that. It held my father even on his tombstone as Sergeant Joe Toy. 506th PIR, 101st Airborne Division. That's what he wanted on his tombstone. It meant that much to him.
Think about your God more than anything else. Think about most of them every day. Something is etched in your memory, I guess. He'll never leave either.
Am I a little proud of having once served in that outfit? You bet your life. I wore that eagle on my right shoulder for 18 years. Probably the proudest thing of my whole life.
The heroes have crosses over their heads, the ones that are buried in the cemeteries. Those are the true heroes, not us. We're just part of the work, that's all. And we thank God we got back alive. That's all.
How would you like to be a mother or a father whose son never come back? The son and the mother and father of the heroes of the Second World War are the guys that come home.
Let me say this. I don't believe there's very, very, very few heroes that came back from the war. They're still over there.
I cherish the memories of a question my grandson asked me the other day when he said, Grandpa, were you a hero in the war? Grandpa said no. But I served in a company of heroes.